Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, guys. Welcome to a unique episode of the Pop Culture Junkie Podcast. This is Haley, and I wanted to kind of set up what you're about to listen to. For anybody who might not know, back in 2020, I had a solo podcast called 30 Nerdy and Thriving. On my podcast, I talked about geeky topics, whatever I loved, whatever I felt passionate about that week. And I had the opportunity to interview some really, really cool guests. Now, before I explain this week's episode, I want to explain kind of why we're doing this. So this is a cool opportunity for me to let everybody listening know that all of my episodes of the 30 Nerdy and Thriving podcast are back. They are live. You can listen to them wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. Pop Culture Junkie is going to be releasing a new episode of the 30 Nerdy Thriving podcast every day until we run out of episodes. We're bringing it back, all the episodes exactly as they were. And so you can catch up if you missed out on 30 Nerdy and Thriving the first time. You know, I'm very grateful for that little podcast that I had because it led to the opportunity to come join the Pop Culture Junkie podcast. So without that, I wouldn't have this. So I'm really grateful for it, and I'm excited to be bringing those episodes back with Pop Culture Entertainment so that you guys can listen to them. Here's the other thing. This episode that you guys are about to listen to is an interview with Michael Genadri. Michael Genadri was on the NBC TV series Ed, starring Tom Cavanaugh and Justin Long and Julie Bowen. And he played Mark, who was the best friend of Justin Long's Warren. We have a great conversation, talk about his career, talk about, you know, stories from the set and memories from filming. This show was and is one of my favorite shows of all time. Unlike all of these other shows that we know and love, Ed is not available for streaming anywhere. And so it's kind of this weird little time capsule of a TV show that, unless you caught it during its original run, you know, there, and or maybe in some reruns, you know, shortly after it went off the air, you're not able to watch it anymore. It's my hope that by putting this incredible, like this episode, by the way, top tier, like one of the coolest moments of my life was being able to sit down and talk with Michael because, as I said, this show was so important to me. And I just, if I could go back in time, you know, and tell my 14, 15, 16 year old self that I would have this opportunity, like I there's no way I would have believed it. So it was so great of Michael to sit down with me. And this actually kind of kickstarted and springboarded this whole other idea of mine. And I'm still working on this amazing, incredible idea and hoping to bring it to you guys pretty soon. But in order for me to do that, here's what I need. I need you guys to listen to this episode. I need you guys to share this episode. I need you to spread it like wildfire. And if you are a fan of Ed, or if you are curious about this TV show and you want it to be streaming somewhere, anywhere, I want you to make your voice heard. I want you to find us on PopCultureJunkie.com, head to our Instagram at Pop.CultureJunkies, find me on Instagram at 30NerdyThriving, leave a comment, send me a message, let me know, hey, I love that show, or I'm so curious, I want to learn more about this. And then that way I can keep you posted and let you know about this cool side project that's coming up. All right, without further ado, enjoy this special episode of the 30 Nerdy and Thriving podcast, my interview with Michael Genaudry. Hey guys, my name is Haley, but my friends call me Haley the Brave, and this is my podcast, 30 Nerdy and Thriving. Each week, I geek out about a different TV show, movie, band, or whatever I'm into that week that I feel the need to share with my fellow nerds. So if that sounds like your cup of tea or your can of Diet Dr. Pepper, then you're in the right place. Let's get nerdy. Well, shave my poodle. Welcome back to the podcast. This is 30 Nerdy and Thriving, and I am your host, Haley the Brave. For anyone just tuning in, I am a mom, teacher, cosplayer, and absolute fangirl who loves to talk about art and entertainment, and I'm happy to have you here. This month's edition of Throwback Thursday is extra special, and I am so excited to share it with you. Today, I'm going to take you back to October 8th in the year 2000. When TiVo and DVR were still new developments. When American Beauty won the Oscar for Best Film. The top Billboard artists were Faith Hill, Santana, Destiny's Child, and Savage Garden. And the world was about to be introduced to the term Hanging Chads. Best of all, our Sunday nights, then Wednesday nights, then Friday nights, were about to be changed for the better with the arrival of NBC's one-hour comedy drama, Ed. Ed was one of the first TV shows that I discovered on my own. I remember seeing the commercial for the pilot and setting my VCR to record it right then and there. What I didn't know then is how important this show would become to me and my life, and the influence it would have over my hobbies, interests, my job, and even ultimately my career choice. So what made it so special? Ed was created by executive producers John Beckerman and Rob Burnett. It starred Tom Cavanaugh as the title character, Ed Stevens, a lawyer who moves back to his hometown of Stuckeyville and buys the local bowling alley. Julie Bowen played Carol Vesey, his high school crush and current love interest, and their will-they-won't-they relationship became the central storyline of the show. Additionally, each episode brought us a new court case, shenanigans at Stuckey Bowl, the trials and tribulations of careers and parenthood with the Burtons, and the highs and lows of high school with Warren Cheswick and company. The exceptional ensemble cast included Josh Randall, Jana Marie Hupp, Leslie Boone, Michael Ian Black, and Justin Long. Not to mention the supporting cast and a giant list of guest stars including Jennifer Goodwin, Mike Starr, Rachel Cronin, Daryl Mitchell, John Slattery, Sabrina Lloyd, and my guest today, Michael Genaudry. Ed received several Emmy nominations as well as Golden Globe noms and TV Guide awards. The pilot drew 16 million viewers, and the show consistently brought in 8 to 10 million viewers each week throughout its first three seasons. Ratings began to dip in the fourth season, and on February 6, 2004, Ed aired its series finale. The story of Stuckeyville and the everyman cast of characters resonated with audiences everywhere. Fans made a pilgrimage to Northvale, New Jersey to get a picture in front of Country Club Lanes, or as we knew it, Stuckey Bowl. They started online communities at Stuckeyville.com, and today, 20 years later, the fandom is alive and well via Facebook groups like Bring Back Ed. Despite numerous fan campaigns, however, Ed has never been available on DVD or via streaming. The Up Network did air reruns of Ed for a short time, but currently the only way to stream the show is on YouTube, courtesy of fans uploading fuzzy, recorded episodes from their VHS tapes. It seems like a lifetime ago that this show united friends and families, taught us life lessons, discussed real-world issues, and left us crying, laughing, and feeling hopeful week in and week out. And even though some time has passed, us fans know that no matter where life takes us, Guam, Borneo, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the truth is we'll be making a beeline right back to Stuckeyville. And you know why? Capital E, lowercase d. Now, while this episode is going to be a special treat for fans of the series, if you're new to Ed or unfamiliar with it, you're still going to enjoy this episode. I am so lucky to be joined this week by an incredibly talented and absolutely hilarious human being. You know him from his role on Ed as Warren's best friend and anchor to reality, Mark Vanacore. He also appeared in 2012's Being Flynn alongside Robert De Niro, and in 2013's Admission with Paul Rudd and Tina Fey. Without further ado, welcome to the podcast, the wonderful Michael Genadri.
Hello there.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I am doing so well. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to do this on behalf of Ed fans everywhere. And there are many of us. And I know that I've been in touch with a lot of them, and they are all very excited about just having any sort of new content to discuss and to listen to. So thank you.
Absolutely. No, I agree with all of that. So it's been far too long. So, hey, Stuckeyville, how you doing out there?
And the crowd goes wild.
We love you. I always have to believe that on some, like somewhere out there in some town, someone has been trying to organize a festival of ducks for years and has just been making it happen. I haven't seen any pictures, but I want to believe they're out there somewhere.
They've got to be.
And every day, so somewhere out in the world, someone's issuing a $10 bet somewhere.
Okay. So yeah, we still are. Like, that's something in my family to this day, we still call lettuce lettuce.
There you go.
We still say burger me. Yep. when we order our meals. So that's very much alive and well. Absolutely. And I think the fandom is alive and well, despite the fact that we haven't had anything in so long. We're holding steady thanks to those awesome people on YouTube who just keep uploading their VCR recordings for us.
That's it. I feel like it's nice to know that at least someone still has a VCR somewhere. Someone's got a VHS collection that's working overtime.
Absolutely.
So that's so it. Funny. If we ever get a digitally remastered collection of this series, like, we're not even going to know what we're looking at. Yeah. Was this really shot on film? Like, everyone's just going to freak out.
Absolutely. I've been rewatching some of my favorite episodes, and it's so funny because at times I'm like, I have to squint to see like who's talking, or the audio gets turned down, or in order to get it not taken off of YouTube, they've been editing out all of the songs. So there's just periods of silence.
Yep.
Oh.
It's like Throwback Thursday every episode. It really is. You're not just showing the show to your family so much as you're just teaching them what it was like to experience home video in the 80s. That's really all you're showing them. It's hilarious.
It's very true. Very true. All right. Well, I'll try my best to not take up too much of your time.
I've taken the day, so we can do whatever we want. Like, I was actually, I'm a little nervous myself, because I have to admit, because I actually looked at my records yesterday and realized that this is actually my first time doing an interview in about 17, 18 years.
Wow. No it's way. Been,
yeah. So no pressure, Haley. That's what I'm saying. So,
okay.
We
all right.
Believe in you. We love you. You can do this.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I promise to set you up for success.
There we go.
Well, very cool. So I'll just tell you real quick a little bit about my fandom and why I wanted to do this episode and why I reached out to you. So Ed came out when I was in high school, and I was probably not the target audience for the show, but it was one of those things where I got to watch it with my family. I got to watch it with my friends. And I think because of your storyline and Warren's storyline, like the high school setting, I think it drew me and my friends in more so than if it had just been the adults, right? And it's so funny because I like I said, I've been rewatching some of those episodes, and now obviously I relate so much more to Carol. I'm a high school English teacher, so me and Carol, like,
okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, so it's been so funny, but like, it is one of those things that has just stuck with me ever since high school and remains one of my absolute favorite shows of all time, but also was just so important as far as like this fundamental time period of like me becoming the person that I became. And Ed was like with me because it was on for 4 seasons. All of my time in high school, like freshman year to senior year, was Ed. And so I just really wanted to have, real talk, one of the main reasons I started my podcast was so I could talk about it. Because I just thought I haven't heard enough people talking about it. And I wanted to find these like-minded individuals who appreciated it and missed it as much as me. And who knows, maybe if the conversation ramps up enough, you know, we will get that digital release at some point. So it's, you know, I'm a big, big fan. And on behalf of like all the fans, again, thank you. And this is just so exciting. Like if I could go back and tell 15-year-old me like that this was going to happen, I would pass out probably. So thanks.
I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. And I can't tell the fans how much we all appreciate it. You know, I don't get a chance to talk to pretty much anyone, but I've heard everyone on the show, as you have, like speak individually about how consistently wonderful the fans have been from day one. I've had some weird experiences with fans. I've had some good experiences, a couple of bad ones, like we all have. But all of them have come from a really genuine place of just love and respect and support. And it's like, you know, a lot of shows say that about their fans. It's like, we got the greatest fans in the world. But seriously, we got the greatest fans in the freaking world. We really do. So I can't thank everybody enough. So, and this show was the beginning for me. This was my television debut. This was everything to me. And it's always meant the world to me to be a part of it. And the fact that it went the direction it did for me, you know, it's like, I would love the opportunity to top that experience at some point in my life, but I might not. It's like walking on the moon for me. The fans just made that extra, extra special.
Ah, man, that's so great. So before we get into talking about Ed, I wanted to know a little bit more about your background and specifically like how you got into acting. Like, did you always want to become an actor? Was that a bucket list thing for you? Or was it just kind of right place, right time?
You know, I've always been one of those people who's kind of like, I take things as they come. I was kind of an aimless kid when I was in grade school and high school, and I didn't really have any idea of like, you know, am I going to go to college? What would I even do? And I had been heavily into performance from that point on, mostly music. I had started singing when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And then I started playing in the school band. I was a concert percussionist and eventually got into jazz and rock drumming when I was a teenager. I was doing my senior year, I was doing concerts like every weekend in different like, you know, concert band, jazz ensemble. I was part of the youth orchestra in the Hudson Valley for a number of years. And, you know, it was mostly music. My first acting gig, I was in sixth grade, and it was like my town was so small. Like my graduating class from high school was like 54 students. And when I was in grade school, we didn't even have a drama program anywhere. In like the high school didn't have a drama program. And around sixth grade, there were some folks that tried to create one. And so they started doing musicals, of course, because they have the biggest cast, so we can include as many people as possible. But I was typically one of those people that I was playing like a different character every scene. So it was like, you know, you get 2 acts, 5 scenes per act, and I'm a different character in each one. So it's great. I'm the biggest guy in the cast, the one that, you know, and each one I'm wearing a different outfit. The wardrobe people were just tearing their hair out. But that was sort of my introduction to acting. I was a huge fan of movies. I wasn't into television all that much when I was a kid. I was a huge Star Trek fan. I think that was as close as it got. But my parents were really old school. So I was watching a lot of like old TV shows that weren't on the air anymore. So it was a lot of I Love Lucy, The Honeymooners, The Dick Van Dyke Show, like anything that would show up on like your local UHF channel at 2 in the morning. That's the kind of stuff I grew up on.
Right.
But I was an only child and I was kind of reclusive. I wasn't really good at making friends. I had friends, I had people who cared about me, but I was very awkward in my relationships. My VHS deck was kind of my best friend growing up. And it wasn't until when it really clicked for me that acting might be a direction I wanted to go. I remember this very clearly. It was my senior year in high school. I had just gotten out of doing, we had done a production of Guys and Dolls, and I played Nicely, Nicely Johnson because I was required to. And afterwards, there was this guy by the name of Joe Garofalo. He was a drama teacher in another school district, and he had come to see the show, and he just felt like there was a lot of talent on this team that wasn't getting a chance. And so he took a bunch of us and he offered to take us to an acting competition in Pennsylvania. And he was like, you know, I'm going to help each of you prepare a monologue for this competition, and I'm going to enroll you in it. I'm going to take you to it. And, you know, we're just going to see what happens. He kind of handed me a couple of, and this kind of shaped how I approached Ed as well. Once I got on it, he had approached me at one point very reluctantly. He was almost kind of scared. And he approached me with two monologues that he had found in his collection. And he was like, these are two monologues that I think you would be great for. I'm not trying to say anything with them, but you know, these are just things I found that I thought you'd be great at. And I didn't have anything else. I'm like, it's probably going to be one of these two. And I don't remember what the second one was, but the first one was this monologue from an Albert Enarado play from the 70s called The Transfiguration of Benno Blimpie. And it was this play in 12 scenes that was very dark. And it was the story about this young man named Benno. He's 20 years old. He weighs about 500 pounds. And he's reached the point where he's decided to end his life. You know, the doctors are telling him that if he doesn't do something about his weight, he's going to die. And he basically decides that's exactly what he wants. So he begins the process of eating himself to death. And the entire play is basically him breaking the fourth wall and explaining to the audience why he's decided to do what he's done. And the monologue that he gave me was this speech in the play where he talks about the one thing in his life that gives him any pleasure, which is art, paintings, drawings. And he goes into this explanation of what it does for him, what, you know, how it makes him feel. But he's always talking in the third person and he's talking directly to the audience. And then over the course of the speech, he starts to talk himself out of loving the thing he just said he loves. And by the end of it, he's made this decision that, you know, not to get too graphic, but he's kind of made the decision that he's going to gouge his own eyes out so that nothing will stop him from ending things. And I remember reading it and being like, dude, I just met you, kind of like, you're handing me this. but it was one of those things where it was like, I couldn't believe that someone handed this to me. But at the same time, I couldn't believe that something like this existed. I'd never seen writing like it up until that point. I connected with that material in such a way where I was like, I feel like this monologue is going to hurt to do, but I feel like I need to do it. I don't care what happens with the competition. I just want to challenge myself by doing this. And I remember we were walking out of the competition at the end, and one of the guys who was helping the judges, he had walked up to me as we were walking out. And with everyone else standing there, he walked up to me and he was like, I just want to let you know that the judges had a really difficult time choosing who was going to be first. In fact, you missed first place by 0.3 of a point.
Oh, gosh.
And I just thought you'd like to know that. And then he left. And I was just silent for the rest of the trip home. And I didn't really know what it meant, but I knew that something was different. And looking back on it, I realized it didn't necessarily tell me that I wanted to be an actor specifically, but it told me that I wanted to be a part of real stories. I wanted to be a part of stories that take people to a place that they recognize that might be painful and say, it's okay. Once I got out into the world, I eventually dropped out of college. I got a job. I was going to a day job on a regular basis. I was working nights as a technician in television. And I remember driving to work one day, and this is in my hometown. I'm still back in the Hudson Valley. And I hear this advertisement on the radio for a local talent manager that was looking for fresh talent to audition in New York City for television and movies. And I didn't really think anything about it. I was just like, oh man, that'd be weird to be a part of. And then I just didn't do anything with it. And then like less than 24 hours later, I'm getting a call from a friend from high school. And she's like, you're going, right?
We all need that friend.
Like, you're doing this. And I'm like, well, I'm thinking about it. And I thought it'd be cool. Like maybe. And she's like, shut up. We're meeting you there. And we're going to do this stuff too. Okay. Unfortunately, a lot of my approach to getting into acting is me just being like, I don't know, I guess I'll try something. And then all of a sudden I get a part in representation and like.
See, that's like kind of kismet though, I think, because, you know, as you were sharing the story about your monologue, I'm thinking in my head, like those stories with heart and those stories that matter and the stories that actually teach people something, you know, long before the likes of A Million Little Things and This Is Us, Ed was the show that was doing that for most of America. Like everybody who was tuning in, like we were getting those lessons. And Ed was interesting because it was perceived, I think, at least initially as a comedy. I think it's primarily a comedy, but there's so much heart and dramatic elements in the show that at least now when I watch TV, I see so many shows kind of following that same pattern of drawing you in with something lighthearted and then just like stabbing you in the gut with something, you know, really, really powerful. And Ed definitely did that. So how did you, was it through that talent manager that you ended up finding your role on Ed? Like, did they bring you in?
Yeah, I was, when I got representation, I had got an agent and a manager and they started submitting me for stuff. I didn't think anything was going to happen for a long time. I was like, you know, You look at Screen Actors Guild literature and they say like it takes the average actor anywhere from 5 to 10 years to break into the business. And, you know, even then you're probably just doing bit parts. So I was, you know, I was on a slow track as far as I was concerned. And then like 2 years into auditioning, Ed just sort of popped up. I was working in New York City. At that point, I was working in Midtown for a TV station on the night shift, but I was living still with my parents in upstate New York. So it was like I was working nights. I had a 2.5 hour one-way commute in order to get to work. And it was just, you know, I'll deal with things as they come. And then the audition came up and it was like 10:30 in the morning. And I'm working from 4 p.m. to midnight. Oh. So really, I wasn't focused on the part as much as I was focused on, I'm going to be too tired to do any of this. I don't remember the audition. I kind of slept through it. I slept through it and I 90-second audition and I left and I was like, well, that sucked. And then just went to work. And that was Friday morning. And then Monday afternoon, I'm on the train on the way to work. I get a phone call from my manager and she just says, you got it.
Wow.
You got it. And it's going to be one day's worth of work. The character's name was Eric Steiner at that point. And he was just described as a slacker kid trying to scheme his way through to graduation. And that was pretty much all I got. And it was 3 scenes, 1 day's worth of work. I took a sick day at my day job and made my television debut.
Wow. That's crazy. Oh, that's so cool though. So now correct me if I'm wrong. The first episode I remember you being in was episode 16 of season 1, I think, where you're trying to persuade Miss Vesey to let you read Johnny Tremaine.
Yes.
For your book report.
That was my first scene. That was it right there. It was called Live Deliberately. And I was kind of upset because I'm a huge stand-up comedy nerd. And the guest star in that episode was Kevin Pollak, who I knew originally from stand-up.
Right.
And we never had a scene together. I was never on set with him. So I was just like, ah!
Oh, and he's brilliant in that episode. He's so
it's amazing.
Funny.
Yeah. One of the things that the show did that I really loved was that kind of you know, you'd have an A story, a B story, and the C story, but there was a theme that connected them. And right. the theme for that one was you had Ed, who's representing this guy who's, you know, he had a near-death experience, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's realized, you know, he's wasted his life. He's wasted all this time. And now he's really just gonna grab life by the hair and just experience.
Right. Do everything, I think. He writes that book.
And so he goes out and he gets into some legal trouble, but he's happy and he's having fun with it. And at the same time, we've got this book report that we're doing in the high school. And, you know, Carol Vesey split us up into reading groups. My character winds up in a reading group with Warren Cheswick and Donna Tazi, I think was her. That was the,
right,
the,
Donna Tazi, yeah.
the girl that he was into at the moment. And the book that we were reading was Walden by Henry David Thoreau, which, you know, is the, you know, I went to the woods to live deliberately. So he's kind of having that realization himself that we're kind of helping him navigate through. I remember, once again, I wasn't thinking much of any of this. I was just like, oh, it's going to be one day's worth of work, but it's my television debut, and that's really all I'm focused on.
Yeah.
I didn't find out until much later. They had been, for multiple episodes at that point, conducting experiments to try and fill a gap within the main cast. And the gap was Warren.
Right.
Because everyone else on the show had a sidekick. They had a doppelganger. They had a best friend that they could play off of and that, you know, would help them to talk through things. Everyone in the show had that except Warren Cheswick.
Right.
So Justin Long was kind of carrying the young people's story in the high school on his shoulders by himself. And it limited their opportunities to really do stuff with him and make Warren a well-rounded character. A lot of those characters, if you look back on them, they were kind of going for something that was personality-wise almost a polar opposite to Warren. So Warren was this like really vibrant, positive, like he's just this big ball of energy. Mm-hmm. And he wants to have like the most, like he's got dreams about wonderful things happening. And, you know, it's just like, and no one's going to stop it. And so all of the characters that they were putting next to him were these like dry-witted, sarcastic, not discouraging him necessarily, but, you know, just being that person who's going to, like, one of my favorite comments that the fans always gave me about my character is like, he says what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Okay. That's exactly what I was going to say is I feel like when Mark comes in, as much as I loved Warren as a character, there are times where his enthusiasm can be a little grating because you're like, okay, you're really naive, you know, like you just don't really get it. And so when Mark's lines were just so perfectly timed to say things that I think put Warren in his place sometimes, maybe dragged him back down to reality a little bit, or anchored him in reality. But on the flip side, also, sometimes I guess Mark's maybe his cynicism, if you want to call it that, or realism, sometimes served as the catalyst for Warren to prove him wrong and to keep pursuing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So I loved it. I thought it was a perfect balance of characters.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, there was a certain adolescent ridiculousness that Mark responded to a lot. One of the great things about the dynamic between the two of them is that they were always kind of inadvertently working together to realize that there's value in remaining down to earth, but the desire for something, you know, idealistic or a fantasy or a dream comes from someplace real as well. Even kids, even teenagers especially, you know, you're surrounded by adults during a time period in your life where you're starting to observe for the first time, really. You know, you're starting to observe the parts of life that the adults around you, your parents, your teachers, guardians, aren't really talking to you about yet. They sort of valued that youthful innocence almost to a level that kind of hurts your development a little bit, hurts your growth. And you're just reaching that point in your life where you realize, oh, that's a thing that they're doing to help me, but it's preventing me from seeing a different angle. Part of the reason they value your innocence so much is because they see in you all of the elements of their youth and vitality and innocence that they feel like they don't get to have anymore because they're in the real world now. And I think what was great about that dynamic between Mark and Warren is we were kind of witnessing those realizations moment by moment in real time over the course of the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think the mentorship too between Ed and sometimes Carol and sometimes Mike even and the younger characters where like in Live Deliberately when Ed is kind of Warren grown up, right? Trying to repeat all of the things that he did in high school. And Warren gets to be the voice of reason a little bit and be like, you know, just simplify. But yeah, that's really cool. Obviously for me being in high school, I related to Warren and Mark, and I was much more, a Warren than I was a, Jessica Martell. We were outcasts a little bit and we were proud of it. We owned that space. And so I loved seeing characters that did the same thing and they'd get knocked down or they'd get knocked back, but it never defined them and it never stopped them. And it never stopped them from being proud of who they were. So I'll never forget that.
It's a difficult line to walk when you're that age, because it's like, you know, you're constantly surrounded by all of the ways in which you see the popular kids as just idiots. They're and it's not a statement towards their intelligence. It's a statement of they're playing a game that you don't see a point in playing. And so, you know, the nerdy kids in school, you kind of start off with that tendency to witness that in the kids around you and overreact. And I always kind of saw Mark as the overreaction. He's the person who's sitting there and being like, well, if I see these elements of you that are stupid and you don't see them, then clearly every part of you is stupid and I'm against it. I don't want any part of any of this. It's like the Miss Stuckeyville episode in season 3, when he explains to Diane, he's like, I like being a loser because we can brood and feel things deeply and make fun of the winners. And that's like that line I loved so much because it's just the epitome of that overreaction of just like you feel so self-righteous about not being a part of the crowd that you revel in it.
Right.
And that was Mark's growth that he needed to do over time. And it makes it a shame that the show ended on a level, because I really would have loved the opportunity to see that growth through to its conclusion. I always wondered like what a graduation day episode would have looked like.
Yeah, we definitely got to see some growth for sure in Mark and Warren, but yeah, there is more to tell in that story. You know, that leads me to kind of my next question, which is like, do you feel that Mark was a fully dimensional character? Like, are you happy with, you know, the way his storyline played out? Is there anything you wish you could have seen happen with him that didn't, or any changes you would make if you could go back in time?
See, the interesting thing about Mark was he kind of started out as a blank slate. He was the only, like, myself and Diane and Eli, once he came in, we were the only characters on the show that were not there from the beginning. So we were not a part of the original design. They hadn't had that 1+ years of, you know, putting together an idea of who this character was before they even shot a frame. I think we never really got around to like a well-rounded Mark, but he was on his way. I think the different ways in which getting gastric bypass surgery changed Mark, and the ways in which it changed us as well. It changed the writer's approach to writing the character, you know, and it changed a number of things. But I felt like we were getting him on the road to being like a truly three-dimensional character. And I think for me, Mark was one of those things where the journey was more important than the destination. Just watching that process of starting with nothing and creating a person, that was the most exciting part to me. And I think a lot of people identified with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, by season three, you were a regular. Your name was in the opening credits. Did that come as a surprise to you that you came from this kind of one-off character and ended up becoming such a huge part of the show? Or was that a collaborative, like, ongoing conversation to get you to that point?
If you had told me from the start that at season one, episode 16, that I would be seeing that show all the way through to the series finale, I would have punched you in the face. Like, don't give me hope. Don't give me hope, man. Like, I'm still trying to figure out day jobs. What are you doing to me? Like, I couldn't believe it when it was happening. You know, I did that first episode, and then 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from my manager, and she's like, "We just heard from the production office at Ed. They wrote your character into the next episode." And I was like, "I have a character?" I just couldn't believe it. And I'll never forget it. We're in the middle of shooting. We had a break on set and they were turning the cameras around. And one of the PAs that I had befriended, she just kind of walked up to me and just got into my ear. And she's like, I just want to let you know, we just got the most recent pages for the next episode and you're in that one too. The first reaction I had was too soon. I started freaking out immediately. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, people ask me, like, you know, what was it like going to acting school? And I'm like, Ed was my acting school.
Yeah.
I didn't do any improvisation on that show.
Okay.
Because I had no confidence, especially standing next to Justin Long. I mean, come on.
Well, so Justin, that was one of his earliest roles too, wasn't it, Ed? It was like him in the beginning.
Yeah. It was his first television. I think he was actually shooting Galaxy Quest in between the period of shooting the original Stuckeyville pilot and the final show that we saw actually getting on the air. So that sort of happened. And so that was that time. But he came from proper training. He had done like improv and sketch stuff during his time at Vassar. Like he came from like a proper professional track. In a way, it kind of worked in our dynamic because I really got the impression that one of the things they were looking to, one of the reasons an actor like Justin was hired was because they wanted someone who they could give opportunities to just go off and play.
Right.
They wanted to, you know, let his imagination run and give us opportunities to just kind of see what happens.
Yeah. You're kind of the straight man in that scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was lucky because I grew up on a lot of Abbott and Costello. My dad was a huge Abbott and Costello fan. So I'd seen all of their movies and I even had like bootlegged VHS copies of like TV performances and USO shows. So I was kind of inadvertently studying comedy teams growing up. When I first saw Justin on set as Warren, it just clicked like, oh, clearly he's Costello. So I should try playing Abbott. And that was what I did. And in the end, I feel like it worked. I feel like there were opportunities that I missed where I might have been able to contribute more, but for what it was and for the level of professionalism I was lacking at the time, I think we managed to make it work pretty well.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. You guys were definitely the Abbott and Costello of the show and one of my favorite parts of the entire series. So I think you guys hit it out of the park.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
Nope.
purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Besides Kevin Pollak, is there anybody else, any guest stars or anybody else in the cast that maybe you didn't get a chance to work with that you wish you could have?
I think I was more amazed by the people I did get a chance to work with. The third episode I was ever in, I got a one-on-one scene with Anne Meara. And I was already like a Stiller and Meara fan, even at that age. And that was just like, you know, I think that was kind of the first time in my life sort of being in the same room with a legend and getting to do a scene with her. And she was like combination professional and sweetheart. She was just wonderful. And she's like, she's one of those people that you look at. I'm like, if I'm going to have any success in this industry and be a celebrity, I want to be that kind of celebrity. Just the person who knows when to stand up for themselves, but knows when to just be just a really decent, sweet, giving, caring person. The biggest one I ever met was Christopher Lloyd. And that episode was amazing because it was a twofer. Because we had two guest stars. We had Christopher Lloyd and we had Michael Winslow.
Oh, right.
So it was like Back to the Future and Police Academy put together in one episode. And so like, I remember everybody just geeking out. That was amazing. Those two together, you were just watching like two different types of masters at work. Like, there were so many of those moments. Taye Diggs playing himself in one episode. Because Taye Diggs is an amazingly good actor, but he's also one of the most gorgeous people that has ever lived. And so like you see him in person, and I didn't even have a scene with him, and I would just see him from a distance and be like, I don't know if I'm allowed to approach him. Is he allowed to be seen around people like me? I don't know. I should check. We had Biff Tannen from Back to the Future as a love interest. He was wonderful. It was one of those shows, like everyone you ran into is one of those things where if you were the type of person who all you ever heard was horror stories about how vainglorious celebrities are, and you spent your time on that set, you'd be like, where are the vainglorious celebrities? Seriously, like these people are terrific. Like Tom Cavanaugh and Julie Bowen were some of the most beautiful people I've ever met in my life. And you were just like, dude, you're stars. You shouldn't be this nice. But yeah, that was just the experience we got to have every week. It was incredible.
Man, that's so cool. That's so cool. And that's you know, again, one of the craziest things to me about the show somewhat disappearing from cultural conversation is how many people either got their start on that show, you know, their first major role, or how many guest stars were on the show, and just the amount of talent that graced, you know, the sets of Ed, it amazes me. We actually talked about my favorite episode already. Live Deliberately is my favorite episode of the series because it was the first one that really showed me that this wasn't a show about more than just a bowling alley lawyer. It was that episode.
It was really the first episode to touch on a sensitive issue. That episode was really the first time that you saw the show be like, let's talk about a deep thing, and let's play with talking about a subject that's not like insensitive. It's not an offensive subject. It's not a thing that's going to make people feel uncomfortable necessarily, but it's still a subject that could go either way. It could be something wonderful, or it could be something tragic and devastating. And I think it's one of the things that made me most comfortable on that show when we started talking about my surgery and my weight loss, was the show's mandate was always first and foremost, this has to be about people. These people are human beings. The people who make up a community, they're all human beings. They're all flawed. They're all idiosyncratic. They've all got their own things going on. We can really talk about any subject we want and keep it lighthearted and fun, but also keep it like real and explorative and informative, as long as we keep it about people.
Yeah. So speaking of that, I want to ask you, so I'm in this group on Facebook. I have to say hi from everyone from the Bring Ed Back group on Facebook. over 1,000 members strong, posting every day their favorite clips and pictures and things from Ed. And
very nice. Hi, bring Ed back. Hi, Facebook group. I love you. We all love you. You're one. I mean, hey, everybody is, everybody that does that stuff is still wonderful to us, the people that still talk about it.
So a lot of them were really excited that I was going to be talking to you. And so they submitted some questions. And so you mentioned, you know, your storyline with Mark chronicling your own weight loss and your surgery in real life. And Greg in the Facebook group, he asked about that. He said he would love to hear about that journey. And he himself had weight loss surgery several years later. So just following up with that, kind of what was that like? Obviously, that's something that is so personal and is happening to you in real life and then is playing out on TV for everyone to see. Was that empowering? Was it terrifying?
I think it would have been a lot worse than it was had I not had the support that I had. I think one of the reasons I felt comfortable doing it was because of how much I trusted the people who put together the show. I had been looking into gastric bypass surgery for a while. My dad got his surgery around the same time I got mine. But we had been talking back and forth together for about a year before I made the decision to go for it myself. And originally, and it's horrible to say this because it would have really screwed a lot of people if I had done this, but I wasn't going to tell anyone. I was gonna see if I could like schedule it during a hiatus. Like I'll get the surgery at the beginning of the hiatus. I'm basically a 24-year-old, 10-year-old at this point. I have no idea how to communicate with others. It would have been a huge mistake if I did it that way. And luckily I never got a chance to do it that way, because in the hiatus between seasons 2 and 3, I get this phone call from the production office, and they're saying, Rob and John would like to meet with you in person in their office. You're not in trouble. They just want to run an idea by you. And, you know, there was a part of me that's like, I'm getting written off the show. Yeah. I don't, you know, it's like, you know, anything could happen. And then there was a dumb voice in my head that's like, I'm getting hired at the bowling alley. I'm becoming a law partner somehow. I have no idea. But I didn't know what was going to happen. And so I went into their office, and Rob and John, who had always been sweet to me, I walk in and both of them seemed kind of nervous. It was like they turned into like this weird comedy team themselves. They were like, we want to talk to you about something. John, you want to let them know what we want to do? And John is like, no, that's okay. If you want to talk to him, that's fine. And it's like, they kept tossing back and forth. I'm like, you know, what's up, guys? So, they looked at me and they were like, well, we had this idea for your character. And if you're not comfortable with it, then we never said it. Like, we were just throwing this out there. We were considering the possibility of maybe writing your weight loss into the show. They didn't really preface that of like where this idea came from. We never really got that far, but I was like, oh, in my head, I was assuming like, oh, they heard that I had talked to a couple of people on set about, you know, maybe considering the surgery. So maybe that's what this is all about. So I looked at them and I said, you know, it's funny that you should mention that, because I recently decided to get gastric bypass surgery. And their eyes just went, like, immediately they were just like, we are now in completely over our heads. Like, what, like, we don't know what to do with that. And I found out later that they were just talking about like Weight Watchers. Like, they were thinking like maybe creating a storyline of like, you know, maybe like diet and exercise something.
It kind of starts out like that with the conversations with Diane, right? In the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was partially them trying to play with an additional storyline, but it was also partially because they were catching the dailies every day and noticing that I was struggling on set. And the biggest struggle, believe it or not, was the romantic scenes between Mark and Diane. The scene where Mark and Diane have their first kiss, and you can actually see it in the finished product in the episode, I was having a lot of difficulty breathing it took place on the staircase of the high school, and I had to actually walk down a set of stairs to get into the scene. And after doing that about six or seven different takes, I was like, I was flushed. I started to look way nervous than Mark should have been in that moment. And so it was really bad. So it was starting to, they were starting to be aware of it. And it was literally just a conversation they were having amongst each other of, they wanted to keep me on the show. They apparently liked me, but they were like, maybe we can use the show to provide him with some assistance and some support. And, you know, in the process of it, you know, we can talk about it with Mark as well. Maybe that would feed that character a little bit. And to their credit, because I think any other show, the second they heard that someone's going to be making as big of a change as gastric bypass surgery, any other show, they would have been like, okay, well, thank you for coming in. And it was good to see you. And then the next script, it'd be like, Mark falls into a wood chipper, the end. And like that, and I think any other show would have gone in that direction. But these guys were different. And so they just approached me and they threw it in my hands. And they said, whatever you want to do, however you want us to handle this, we'll follow your lead. We're here for you. We want to support you. Rob Burnett actually got me in touch with the guy who became my dietitian, and he, you know, they helped me find a good reliable surgeon to go through the entire process. And they were like, whatever we can do to help, we want to help. However you want to cover it on the show, that's how we'll talk about covering it, but we're not going to do anything unless you're comfortable with it. And I think that level of support just opened up everything for me.
Wow. That's such a cool story. I mean, talking about a show that was about people from the very beginning and telling these real stories, I think your story and Mark's story with the gastric bypass surgery was one of the realest things to happen on the show. Obviously, not only because you were going through it in real life, but because of the way that they handled it, which, you know, I remember after the surgery, there's the whole plot with Mark's friend who's considering getting the surgery, and Mark dealing with the guilt of being the poster boy of gastric bypass and not wanting to promote that to other people for fear of the risks associated with it. And I just thought it was done so responsibly, respectfully, and in a way that never took any value away from Mark. It never said, you know, Mark has to do this, or this is the way that Mark becomes a valuable character. It was,
sure,
it was, Mark is valuable and that's why he's doing this. And, you know, and I just thought that it was so well done. And some of those scenes, like with Mark and his dad, they were tough. They were tough to watch and really emotional. And, It was cool as a fan, because you feel like you're going on this journey with him and you're proud of his progress. And it was just really cool to see.
Yeah, it was difficult. Like, I really credit the writers for finding a really good balance, because on the one hand, you know, you wanted to cover this as realistically as possible. And like that was part of the reason why I said, let's just give Mark the surgery, because they were like, you know, thinking, you know, maybe Weight Watchers, maybe, you know, some other program, we don't have to necessarily do the surgery. And I'm like, if we're going to do this, let's do it as realistically as possible. And once again, we got to just make this about Mark. You know, this is a thing that Mark is doing for himself. He's not trying to suggest what is the right or wrong thing to do. We're not trying to give even the slightest impression of, you know, we're trying to set an example for others. And I think that's what made that episode that you talked about so important, where they introduced Jimmy Wrestler and we started talking about the whole poster boy thing. That episode, which I think out of all of the episodes we did about it, is the one I love the most, because it was clear that episode came from the writers watching what was happening to me in the media while I was doing all of these interviews and they were covering the surgery, because I was getting questions from the media about what we, not just my experiences with the surgery or my experiences being obese, but everyone's assumptions of what we meant by talking about it on the show. There was a lot of assumptions being thrown around. Like the first TV interview that I did was on the Donahue Show on MSNBC. And the Donahue Show was like, it was a panel show in front of a live audience, and you're talking about a specific subject over the course of an hour. And the first interview was me. And so I'm sitting in front of this live audience, and this is my first time being interviewed on camera. And I've never done it before, so I don't know what to expect. And I'm this, like, you know, timid guy who's like, I don't volunteer a whole lot of information. I don't talk all that much. And he asked me a whole bunch of questions that were, you know, relatively, you know, when did you start getting fat? What was your heaviest recorded weight? What made you decide to get the surgery? A lot of basic questions. And then, like, I start seeing out of the corner of my eye, the floor director is giving him like the 30-second signal, like 30 seconds to commercial, you got to wrap it up. And at that point, he hits me with this question, and I'll never forget it because it pissed me off. Do you think kids should get this? And I was like, a couple of things. First off, the second he said it, I knew it was the question he wanted to ask me the whole time. Like that was where he really wanted this to go. Like, and he saves it until the 30-second mark. In 30 seconds, we're going to go to commercial. No one, even if you had an answer prepared, no one could answer that question in 30 seconds.
Right.
And have it be a useful answer. Like, it was just ridiculous. It was never about, you know, what are we saying about should kids get this? We didn't approach gastric bypass surgery as a political topic.
Right.
When we were making the show, it was just supposed to be about Mark, but Mark was 17. You're giving the first time on television that a fictional character is getting gastric bypass surgery. You're giving it to a 17-year-old. And once you do it, and once you air it, that moment doesn't belong to you anymore. It now belongs to the world, and the world gets to interpret from it whatever they wish. And so that was when I found out that there was this entire group of people out there who saw us giving the surgery to a 17-year-old, and immediately they were like, they're trying to influence our children. There was an entire media apparatus out there that kind of wanted me to be the poster boy. They were in search of a poster boy for this. And it was partially them wanting someone like that, and partially people in the entertainment industry just assuming that that's what I wanted.
Right. Thinking, oh, well, if you did this, then you must want all the attention for it.
Yeah. And you wouldn't talk about something this personal in public if you weren't looking to profit off of it.
Right.
It was so offensive on every level, but I didn't have what it took. I wasn't adult enough. I wasn't experienced enough to put together the words to say anything about it. And then all of a sudden, this episode drops in front of me where we're talking about, like, how horrible it is to think of me as the poster boy. And it was like feeling seen.
Yeah. You're like, this is what I've been trying to say this whole time.
Yeah. It was like, I didn't know how to find the words, and the words are here in this episode. And so that to this day, that episode means more to me than anything. And even Wallace Little, the guy who plays Jimmy Wrestler on the show, I remember he and I having extensive conversations about it through that whole thing. And I'm still getting interview requests, and all this stuff is happening. I think shooting that episode sort of helped me figure out how to get to the other side of that hurricane.
Yeah. Wow. That episode, it's really powerful, and it puts the cap kind of on that story for Mark. You know, it doesn't really get revisited again after that. And I thought that was good because, yeah, Mark was more than that, and you were more than that. Want to go back to Jennifer Goodwin as Diane. And Mark and Diane's relationship and their love story, which is one of the cuter love stories, I think, on TV, especially with high schoolers, because usually high school TV romances annoy me, but not Mark and Diane's. I liked theirs. So Whitney, another fan from the group, she wanted to know, at the end of season 2, when there was kind of the love triangle going on between Diane and Warren and Mark, were you team Warren or were you team Mark?
Oh, man. Oh, I love that question. Oh. I mean, let's face it. I think I've always been team Warren needs to relax a little bit. I think that's the best description of it. I mean, honestly, I think one of the best things about Ed was that there were no teams. I think that was one of the things that people really identified with is that, like, you know, you could be comfortable in a relationship like Warren and Mark's, even when things get heated, because you know that there really isn't a team Warren or a team Mark. They're there for each other. That was an important thing about the show as well. Like, there's nothing wrong with fighting. Between friends, between family, fighting is always a good sign because you don't fight with people you don't care about. That was a really big part of all of that. Like, you know, you weren't really focused on which one of them is going to get to have Diane. Diane decides who gets to have Diane.
Right.
What you were really concerned about was, are they still going to be friends after this? And it was hilarious because it changed my dynamic with the fans. First of all, like prior to that time period, I was running into people on the street and it was just very basic. Like, oh, are you that guy on Ed? Cool. Can I have a picture? And like pictures and autographs and that kind of stuff. Then that happened and people would walk up to me and they were like, are you that guy on Ed? Why you gotta take Warren's girl like that, man? It's like, it was hilarious.
I love the scene at the carnival, like at the end of season two, where Warren comes to his senses and he realizes, like, if I don't have them, I don't have anybody and I'm being an idiot. And I just think it's such a relatable thing.
And Mark and Diane are just having that reaction to him, are like, you know, have you gotten over it? Are you with us now? Can we go back to having fun?
Yeah. Yeah. They were just waiting. They were just waiting for him to deal with it.
Yeah, they knew he would eventually, but he had to work through some stuff.
Now, you say there's no teams, but I will tell you that there is a big debate over Team Frankie versus Team Carol. And I was surprised to learn that because I was always Team Carol. I felt like the whole show was leading up to Ed and Carol getting together.
Yeah.
But I was surprised to learn that there is quite a big section of the fan base that believes that Carol did not deserve Ed and that Frankie was the one who should have ended up with Ed. What are your thoughts?
Well, man, that's loaded. That is a loaded question.
Isn't it though?
I mean, you know, I totally understand the people who don't think that Carol deserved Ed. Because there is that kind of traditionalist like attitude of, you know, well, if she really deserved him, she would have realized it in high school.
Right.
Like, you know, he's the same guy.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, no one like matures in their 30s enough to like not be the type of person to walk into your classroom in a suit of armor.
Right.
With flowers and a camcorder. That's the same guy.
Yeah.
You know, why did it take you this long to wake up? Of course you don't deserve him. But at the same time, you know, I understand wanting him to be with Frankie because there's an element of, there's just enough of an element of free-spiritedness with Frankie that you see more of a chance of Ed getting to keep the vibrant, high-spirited nature that makes Ed, Ed.
Right.
You know, there's that feeling of like, he's going to have that more long-term with someone like Frankie than with someone like Carol. But at the same time, there's also that realization of, the problem with free spirits is they usually wind up desiring to be free. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Frankie kind of increases the chances that that's not going to end well.
Yeah.
Somewhere in another dimension, he and Frankie have had a relationship. And in one dimension, it ended great. And in one dimension, it ended poorly.
There you go. I'm sure it existed in fan fiction somewhere along the lines.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I always felt like Ed and Carol had to end up together. It was the crux of the show. But also, I think, like you said, there needed to be balance in a relationship and Ed and Carol balanced each other out. But I think that their relationship, along with Warren's growth and Mark's growth and what happens to the Burtons and just their whole plot line with Mike getting his own practice. I feel like one of the main lessons of the show was this idea of not selling yourself short, not, you know, Warren always saw himself as less than, and so he was always trying to be something bigger than he was when being himself was good enough. Carol always felt like she didn't deserve Ed because of just who she was and how she hadn't really formulated this kind of strong identity in and of herself. And, you know, that goes on and on and on. Even Ed chasing after Carol from the very beginning was, I deserve the dream. I deserve the dream life that I've wanted since I was a kid. And so I think that's one of the most powerful lessons that always stuck with me was go after the thing that you want because you're worthy of it and you deserve it. And whatever that may be. And we see that in the whole cast, in Phil working at the bowling alley in, I can't think of his name. He worked at the bowling alley with Phil and Shirley and then left.
You're talking about Kenny.
Yes, Kenny. Yeah, when Kenny gets so close to bowling his perfect game and then he just walks away from it.
Oh, that was the best. That was the best departure ever. Oh, that was like,
I loved it.
If there was any character that deserved to walk away a legend, it was Kenny Sandusky.
Yes, I loved it so much. I loved that they gave Kenny this amazing exit and that his story was like, it was worthy. It was like a worthy story of this. And I just love that. I love that Shirley got her due. Like everybody, Eli's whole plot, when he comes in and how low he feels about himself and about his transformation of breaking out of his shell and seeing the value in himself again, that others saw in him all along, like just over and over and over again, this recurring theme of not selling yourself short, seeing the value in yourself. As a kid in the formative years of my youth, from, you know, becoming an adult, turning 18 during the final season of Ed,
yeah,
that really stuck with me. And so much so I got a job at a bowling alley because I wanted to be reminded of that good, positive feeling that I got when I watched Ed. But it's because of that feeling. And I love that. I think to me, that's what made Ed special. John Beckerman said that Ed was a place to reflect on what is good and silly and fun about life. And I think there will always be a place for that, or I hope there always will be. Yeah, to me, I feel like there's been nothing like it. The positivity, the positive messages, the real life storytelling, and using all the while using quirky, off the wall, bizarre humor that would just crack you up and have you in stitches. I really, 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 really miss it. And I just think it was one of the most special and unique shows ever. But what for you, being on it, what made it so special for you? Like what, when you talk about Ed, what is like the thing that you think sets it apart from all the other stuff out there?
As a show, I think what really sets it apart is a lot of the things you just said, and that it really was about settling inside of a town and letting your love of that group grow. I think one of the things going back to the conversation of Carol versus Frankie, one of the points that you made about Carol not deserving it is that she, you know, yeah, she didn't feel like she deserved Ed, but part of the reason that she didn't feel like she deserved him was because there was still an element of that old high school small town game that she played back when she was the popular girl in school that was still kind of ruling over how she saw her life and how she saw the world. Whereas Ed was a person who was never immersed in that in high school and got away from it. He left. He went to New York. He had a job. Like he experienced the outside world and came back. And he came back a more well-rounded person for his experiences there, but he did come back in search of something. And part of what he was in search of was Carol, but not the Carol he remembered from high school, the Carol that he saw when he looked at her and realized that she was always capable of being. And so it was kind of an underlying theme of the entire show of, you know, the show itself just being about patience, finding people in this world that you care about and realizing that the best way to help them is to be there for them and be patient as they make changes and as they try to figure stuff out in the world. Because we're all on our own journey with our own issues, our own problems, our own misconceptions about life and about the world, trying to figure out our own stuff. And the only way we're going to get to the other end of that is if we've got a community around us that says, go screw up. Like, screw up, have your bad experiences, we'll have our fights, but you can at least rest easy in the fact that we're here and we're always going to be here. We're here for each other. And I think that message was far more unique than it should have been on television. I would always giggle a little bit when people would say about Ed, it was ahead of its time. Every once in a while, someone will say, like, Ed was ahead of its time. Ahead of its time is a really romantic notion, but it's really just kind of a nice, polite way of saying, we don't know how to market your show. That's basically what it means.
Well, and I remember Ed was like the lead in for the West Wing, which I always was like, this is so strange because there's no part of me as an Ed fan that wanted to watch the West Wing. And I'm sure there were people that did watch both of them, but yeah, it was not the same thing. It was not, Brooklyn Nine-Nine leading into 30 Rock or something. It was completely different genres.
Yeah. And it made sense from the network standpoint because, they're like, it's the West Wing and then Law and Order. We can't advertise, NBC Intellectual Grimdark Wednesday.
Yeah.
That's not going to work. We got to have at least a little bit of fun on Wednesday night. And so that's kind of.
So we'll throw some waffles at the window and then we'll get into the really gritty crimes.
Yeah. Exactly. But it made sense also because, it was a dramedy. So you could kind of keep it attached to the drama that's going to come in the shows afterwards.
Yeah.
But it was also kind of a lighthearted sort of you're settling down into your evening.
I remember realizing Ed was like a big deal when I went to school and I hadn't really been talking to anyone about it because I didn't assume anyone was watching it. And I was sitting in student council and I said, kind of jokingly, hey, did you guys ever notice that our Spanish teacher looks like this guy that plays Ed? He looks like this Tom Cavanaugh guy. Everyone in my whole student council just starts like in succession naming off $10 bets, just like all in order because they'd all been watching it. And then my teachers jump in and they're like, oh, did you see the commercial for next week? And did you guys see this? And who do you? And it blew my mind. I was like, wait a second. We've all been watching this together and had no idea. And then spent the whole rest of the school year, like we'd show up to class and that's all we'd do is we would just talk about it. It became a tradition for us. But yeah, that was the first time I really realized like, oh, this is a big deal. This is more than just me and my parents watching this together.
I knew that it was probably something long-term big when I met the woman who is now my wife. The story she tells is funny because at the time after Ed got canceled, I was pretty much done. I wasn't getting any other work for a bunch of different reasons, but I went back to like day jobs and, just kind of the working class life. One of the things that I was doing, I had moved to Los Angeles by that point. And my first wife and I, we were the building managers in the apartment building that we were working in. That we were living in. And she was a student at UCLA and she and a few friends were looking at, an apartment in our building. And I didn't find this out until much later, but she had apparently come with her mother to check out the apartment. And I was the one who gave them the walkthrough. And the entire time I'm showing them the apartment, they're kind of sneakily looking at each other like, doesn't he sound like that guy? Like, I'd had so many people up to that point who like saw me out in public and they were just like, I saw you and I didn't think you were you. And then I heard your voice and I knew. And so that's what was going on with them, apparently.
How funny.
Much later on, after like we had been friends for a couple of years and then we started dating and then I met her parents. And the day that I go to meet her parents, she's like, I just want to warn you in advance they're Ed fans. It's going to come up. It's going to come up. They're going to say something. I have told them to behave. And like, they're going to try and curtail it a little bit, but I'm just saying at some point you might get some Ed questions. Just be ready. And they worked so hard for like the first couple of hours to not say anything. And then they eventually mentioned like a little Ed something. And I was like, sure, go ahead. And then 6 hours later, I've told them everything. At some point, I forget exactly when it was, I decided that I was going to present them with a gift just to say thank you for everything. And I had presented them with a thing that a lot of us got after the show ended, which was we had each gotten a bowling pin that everyone in the cast had signed.
That's awesome.
And so I just kind of presented them with that, and they've got it on their mantle, and it's like one of their favorite pieces. And but going through that entire thing with them, that was when I realized like, this is going to be a part of me forever. And I am more than okay with that. I love it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Okay. So I'll ask another fan question. This one is from NATO. He asked, do you still keep in touch with Jennifer and Justin or anybody from the cast?
I haven't kept in touch with anyone, and it's my fault. Like I said, I am so terrible. I was so scared when I was on the show. I was very worried about being a burden on others or approaching people. Like I was so lacking in confidence that I never really developed relationships with everyone. And I think all of my experiences were just people like just really lovingly tolerating me. And I there wasn't a single person on that show that I had a problem with. I didn't dislike anyone. I would love to contact all of them. I would love to try. Like Justin and I never got to have that kind of friendship. I would love to have that. Ginny's career, I've been watching like crazy. I was a huge Big Love fan. Her stuff on Once Upon a Time was wonderful. And, you know, every time I see her in something, I'm just so happy. I'm so proud of both of them.
I think it's time for an Ed reunion. That's my vote. I think it's time to get the band back together.
I'd be more than happy to host a panel discussion if anyone wanted to put that together.
So cool.
Let's make it happen. I know we're connected on Twitter. I think that's the only place. But I suck at social media completely. I've never been good at it.
I think, you know, right now with everything with the pandemic and having to readjust the way we communicate and everything, it's thankfully afforded, you know, me this opportunity to have this podcast and chat with you, which will go down as one of the coolest experiences of my life. So thank you for that.
I tried really hard to be as brilliant as possible, so I hope I've succeeded.
Well done. Well done.
Oh, man.
David asked, who in the cast is most like their character in real life and who is the most different from their character?
Ooh, okay. Most like their character, Tom. Absolutely. Like Tom is like, it was like kismet putting those two together, Tom and Ed. Nearly all of my memories of Tom Cavanaugh involve music because he always had an acoustic guitar with him. I was in the high school, and for the first season, the high school was on location. So we were not on set. So I never actually got to see the set of Ed or the bowling alley or any of those things until much, much later. My first memory of Tom Cavanaugh was in the bowling alley, and they had been filming, but they were sort of in between, and he was relaxing. He was sitting in Video Village, which is where they set up everyone's chairs to sit in front of the monitors and watch what's going on in the camera. He was sitting in Video Village. I'm not making this up. He was sitting there by himself with an acoustic guitar singing Britney Spears covers. Just to pass the time.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I just walked in. And I'm like, that's Tom Cavanaugh, and that's Hit Me Baby One More Time. I don't know what's going on, but I love it. And I'm honored to be a part of all of it. The night that we shot all the stuff on the Ferris wheel, that whole thing, it was the middle of March, and we were trying to pretend it was the middle of June. And so it is freezing cold outside in the middle of the night in northern Jersey. And we were shooting until the sun came up. And it was a whole difficult sequence because there was like three cars that were taken up. There was Mark and Diane in one car. And then you had the Burtons in one car. And then you had Ed and Carol in another car. And a crane cam that was following them shooting the different parts bit by bit. And in each of the cars, just so that we could talk to the director and ask for any assistance, each car had a walkie-talkie that so we could speak to them. And then out of nowhere, and I love him for what he did in this moment, out of nowhere, Tom just picks up the walkie-talkie, changes it to the channel that all of the tech crew is on, so that his voice can boom throughout the entire fairgrounds. And he just starts making up songs. Like he just came up with a line and he's just singing like, roll the goddamn camera, because the actors are all freezing. And he's just bouncing. And Julia's just sitting next to him. I'm like, I'm on the clock, so I'm doing it too. And she's like dancing along. And I'm laughing so hard, like Ginny thought I was going to die. She thought I was like, I was worried I was going to collapse the entire thing and kill everybody. But it was just, it kept us warm while we were sitting up there. And like everyone in the crowd loved it. And it was just, it's a lot of weight to carry on your shoulders when you're the star of a TV show. When the show is named after you, that's a lot of weight. And he really recognized that, you know, when you're number one on the call sheet, you know, there's an opportunity and an obligation to, when you're not acting, try to be a positive force amongst everybody. And he was just naturally brilliant at that at all times. He just made everyone feel better whenever he was there. That's my best memory of him.
Ah, that's great.
Your other question, least like their character, I would have to say Rachel Cronin, who played Shirley Pifko.
Okay.
That wasn't even a performance. That was a transformation.
Really?
Like she was nothing like that character in any way. Wow. And it was like an on-off switch. Like the second they said cut, she was Rachel again. And the second she said action, she was Shirley. And it was just astounding.
Gosh, I really think that Shirley might be my favorite character in the whole show. She shows up in the most unexpected times sometimes and killed every scene that she was in, like completely stole it. Okay, this is the last fan question. And, you know, we'll see. It's the question that I get from pretty much everyone anytime I talk about Ed.
Pretty certain I already know what the question is.
This comes from Cody, but I'm going to put Cody asterisk. Every Ed fan on the planet asks,
yes,
do you know the real reason why Ed is not available on DVD or via streaming, or who we can reach out to in order to make it happen? I know at least the word among the fans is that it had something to do, at least initially, with music licensing and the rights to the music. And that's why it wasn't initially put on DVD. But I do know in recent years, some other shows who face those same challenges, they would go back and they'd change the music in the scenes or something so that they could re-release it. What's the deal? Why don't we have Ed anywhere?
Well, okay. Like how deep into the business do you want to go? Cause like I, there is an answer to that question, but it's very complicated and it's a lot of business stuff. Music is definitely a part of it. But I think it has less to do with what music was used and more when the show was on the air. Because you got to keep in mind, like we were on from 2000 to 2004. And that time period of 1999, 2000, 2001, that was the peak when like Napster and BitTorrent and file sharing was in the process of decimating the revenue stream of the entire recording industry. The lawsuit that the music industry had against Napster, that was 2001. So we were like end of season one, beginning of season two, which is why during season two, all of a sudden we had
the theme song changes.
Yeah. And while we're on, just to put it out there, poor Clem Snide. I mean, like the band, they're a great band, Moment in the Sun is a terrific song. They're still out there. They're on, check them out on iTunes. They're on Spotify. They're making albums. They're a terrific band. They didn't deserve what happened. You know, the recording industry, they really only make money from two revenue streams. They've got retail sales and they've got music licensing. So when the revenue from one goes down, the price of the other goes up. And so, you know, it really has been in the stratosphere this whole time. But that's actually been good news, because over the last few years, since like 2017, roughly, the recording industry has started to see consumer spending go back up again, because the recording industry has kind of started to figure out how to monetize the internet better. They're starting to figure it out. And I think in terms of getting to see the show again, I think that's really going to help to kind of bring those licensing prices down more and more until eventually it can be cost effective again. I have no insider information. I haven't been talking to anyone at the network or at the studio, you know, so I'm speculating like everyone else, but I've had enough business experience to kind of connect the dots a little bit and see what's going on. And I think what's counterintuitive is that when you think about it, the reason you've never seen Ed on DVD is also kind of the reason we were able to stay on for four seasons instead of just one. Because television is first and foremost about advertising revenue. The commercials are really why the show exists. The show itself, you know, gets you to watch. And then the advertising is what they use to pay their bills and pay our salaries. We were a popular show, but not popular enough for broadcast television at that time, you know. But we had a couple of things going for us. The first thing was that all of the surveys were suggesting that our audience skewed wealthier. So there was a lot more purchasing power amongst the people who watched our show. So that beefed up the ad buy that we could suggest. So we were getting a lot of really decent prices for the advertising on the show. And then also we had a very loyal following. You know, our numbers were really consistent. They didn't fluctuate too much from week to week. We were consistently 8 to 10 million viewers every single week. You could set your clock to it. That meant that our audience was less likely than other shows to start channel surfing when the commercials came on. The low numbers were why we were on the bubble at the end of every season, but those elements regarding advertising were what kept us from getting canceled all of those years. Once you start talking about DVD and Blu-ray sales, marketing doesn't apply. There is no ad revenue. So you're relying entirely on the popularity of the show amongst its fans. And at the same time, you're talking about physical media. You're talking about something that you have to manufacture and produce, keep in warehouses. And put. So there's a whole bunch of logistics involved that you got to be able to reliably say, if we're going to produce this much, we're still going to make a profit. The developments in streaming, I think, are the most promising right now.
Right. When the Peacock app came out, I think all of us assumed Ed was going to be on it. We thought, oh, we're going to get it back now.
I think for the most part, you know, it's still very new, you know, like Peacock is still the newest of all of those new streaming services. And I think, you know, part of the reason is, you know, the traditional broadcast networks, the companies that have been around the longest are the ones that have been the most reluctant to make that kind of conversion. You know, when you've been stuck seeing your industry as being a specific way for so long, when you talk about completely upending your entire industry, all you see is what it's going to cost you. All you see is how much it's going to hurt to get you to the other side of it, to a point where it can actually be profitable for you again. And all of it is guesswork. It's all predictions of where we think it's going to go. So there's been a lot of experimentation. And especially for a show like Ed, it's very difficult because we were produced by two companies. The production company was Paramount Television, which was a division of Viacom, but the distributor was NBC Universal. And both of those companies have rival streaming services now.
Oh, right. That's true.
Who's going to get the licensing? But I think, you know, viewers are as they start dipping into their back catalogs, viewers on these streaming services are eating through those back catalogs so quickly that, you know, both of those companies are eventually going to reach a point, probably sooner rather than later, where they realize, you know, if we want to have new stuff to show, we need to start talking about those shows we haven't talked about in a while. I think it's only a matter of time. And Ed's going to be back in the conversation again. And then before you know it, you know, maybe this conversation will help. Maybe this episode is going to be like, hey, get this out there, pass it out to all your friends.
Fingers crossed. Every Ed fan listening, send this to everyone that you know so that we can get Ed back on streaming.
To everyone who won't speak to you anymore because you won't shut up about Ed, send them this episode. Tell them Mark Vanacore sent you.
Okay, so would you ever want there to be like an Ed reboot or an Ed revival, or do you think it's like better to let it lie and just let the original speak for itself?
I think it's better to just let it lie. I mean, I feel like I always get wary when you talk about reboots or anything like that, because it's kind of what separates a show from feeling dated to feeling like a time capsule.
Some things are just better left the way they are. And I've had some of my favorite things be revived or rebooted or have some sort of continuation. And sometimes it's hit or miss, but for the most part, I feel like it has done more harm than good. And so even though it's tempting to capitalize on nostalgia, I think it's good to leave Ed what it is and let it be that time capsule, like you said. But if there was an Ed revival, or we get an Ed reunion and we got to pick up with the characters now in 2021, what would Mark Vanacore be up to today?
Oh boy. I feel like he'd be a writer. I always did kind of get the impression when we were creating that character that he was almost kind of an extension of the writers in a way. Because, like, once again, he was saying what people were thinking. You know, we did have those moments, especially when we covered the surgery, of like making him a gourmand, like he's really into like sophisticated foods and that kind of stuff. But I don't think that means he would be a chef. I think it means he'd be more like a food critic. He's the person who likes to go try awesome food and then write a confusing article to tell you how much it sucked.
It is so spot on to his character, being able to kind of tear other people down for being wrong and all the while tasting all the delicious foods in the world. I love that.
That's it. He's gonna sit in that restaurant for 2 hours and try like 6 different courses and just be like, oh man, oh, this is wonderful. This is, and then go back to his hotel room and be like, you know, just like, capers were too salty, 2 stars.
Oh, that's great. Oh man. All right. Well, the fans want to know, do you have any current or future projects coming up that they can follow, that they can support you?
I've been focusing mostly on writing ever since my father passed away in 2017. And ever since then, I've been kind of rejiggering my life. And it's put me in more of a position to try and be more creative. So I've been focusing a lot on writing. I am still trying to get into acting. It's been an opportunity to try and figure out, to delve into more creative outlets. So I'm looking to see if I can possibly, you know, write and get picked up a TV series of my own, or, you know, maybe a feature film of some kind that I've been working on. For the most part, it's like I'm on Twitter. I have a Facebook page, and you know, I'm always looking out for folks. So if anything comes up that I manage to get going on, anyone who follows me out there is going to be the first to know.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Michael. This has been the coolest experience ever. I guarantee there's a lot of people that are excited to listen to this, and I'm sure we'll find you on social media and ask you a bunch of follow-up questions.
Well, we got the fans out there. We got to keep our hope together. And I really think, like I said, it's only a matter of time. We're going to be back in Stuckeyville celebrating together before we know it.
Yes. All right. Well, my next project is to try to put together that reunion panel. That is going to be my next bucket list item. So
I am there. I'm there. I'm on it. Keep me posted.
Will do.
So, and I'm going to keep listening to you, Haley. I've really appreciated your show. I'm a TV nerd myself, so I have so much fun with a lot of different programs. You actually talked on your show about a few shows that I need to check out myself. So
thank you so much. It was so nice talking with you, and I wish you the best of luck in your writing, and obviously I'll be following and cheering you on all along the way.
Thank you, Haley. I had a blast.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
You guys, how cool was that? Was that not the coolest thing in the entire world? Yes. Yes, it was. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much to Michael Genadri for being willing to come on the show and share the behind the scenes stories and geek out over Ed with me. I had an absolute blast. I truly appreciate it. It was so much fun. Don't forget to go follow Michael on Facebook and Twitter. I put the links to his profiles down in the episode description. If you've never seen Ed and you want to see what all the fuss is about, search for Ed Full Episodes on YouTube and join in on the fun. Ed fans, let's keep the ball rolling. Please share this episode with everyone you know. Let's make that Ed reunion panel a reality. Let's plan our own festival of ducks. We can cater it with waffles and fine Corinthian turkeys. Let's do it. Spread the word, spread the love. Let's bring back Ed for a whole new generation. Okay, before I let you go, $10 if you give me $10. Okay, not really, but if you want to support the podcast, buy me a coffee. The link is in the podcast description to donate. Help me pay for Squadcast or Zoom Premium so I can interview multiple people remotely at one time. Okay, seriously though, $10 if you yell, "I love kitties" at the top of your lungs. Again, you can call in and leave a voice message for the podcast, and I might just play it on next week's episode. That link is in the episode description, of course. And finally, $10 if you order your next meal in Rhyme. And I expect a full report. Message me and tell me how it goes. You can find me on Instagram at 30NerdyThriving, or on Facebook, 30NerdyAndThriving, or on Twitter at 30NerdyPod. If you're listening to this episode, please take a screenshot, post it on social media, and tag me in your post. I would love to link up with all of my fellow Ed fans. Thank you guys so much for liking, subscribing, rating, reviewing, and most of all, for listening. Have a great rest of your day, and I'll see you same time, same place, next week. Until next time.